When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Coast of Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Alyssa Wilkinson, who is a film critic for The New York Times, formerly a senior correspondent and critic at Vox. We are here to discuss Alyssa's new book, newish book. It came out last month to raves
three weeks ago.
Great sales.
And, yeah. Well... Yeah. You know how it is. I have no idea what the sales are at this point, but let's
hope. Right. No. We tell ourselves stories, Joan Didion and the American Dream Machine. And I'm excited to talk about this because I am a writer. As a writer, I think I'm required by law to like Joan Didion. That's in the Constitution somewhere, right, Alyssa?
That's correct. You have to like her, and if you ever live in New York and consider leaving, you have to write an essay that's a spinoff of Goodbye to All That. Those are the two rules.
That sounds precisely right. Now, I wanted to have you on today because, Joan Didion is fascinating, not just because she was... great writer, great columnist, great essayist, mm-hmm. Whatever, all those superlatives. But she really did kind of hit that intersection of culture and politics that I find very interesting, that I am, kind of obsessed with. Mm-hmm. And one thing I had kind of known this, but I hadn't really realized it fully, is that before she became Joan Didion, before she was Joan Didion, essayist, screenwriter, et cetera, she was a film critic for a while, I find really interesting, and I kind of knew that, but not really. Her work hasn't been collected anywhere, which is a crime. We got to get you on that.
I'm ready and willing.
but when you were looking back at her criticism, what jumped out at you as something, a signpost for future writing and future interests?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to read her criticism, most of which was written when she was in her 20s and early 30s and living in New York City. And before she picked up a regular film reviewing gig, she was writing criticism for a number of publications, which included National Review, which was still pretty young at the time. And she wrote a lot of really good and interesting and kind of like very confrontational literary criticism. And then she was working at Vogue at the time. And so a spot opened up and they had basically two critics who would alternate a column every issue. So she landed the spot in whatever way, we don't really know, but she wrote a column, and it was a literal column because, print magazine, it's not much space on the page and it's like lined by ads and you can see them in the archives and they're for like, I don't know, whatever they were advertising in the mid 60s in Vogue. Pantyhose. But in the middle is her column, and she starts out professing basically that she loves movies as entertainment and doesn't really need them to be art, which is perhaps not what people would expect from her. I think a lot of people have the perception that she was a very elitist person when it came to art, and I don't actually think that's true at all. I understand where the perception comes from, but she really, really loves movies, and she really loves movies that entertain her, even if they're kind of stupid. And she doesn't love movies when they try too hard to yeah, I guess rise to the level of experimentation or something like that. I mean, it's the mid-60s, and she is uninterested in the French New Wave. She has no use for, like, the underground film scene in New York at the time. She really likes movies that, as she puts it, have moments, which are like, you know, Charles Lindbergh crossing the ocean in his plane and the music swells, and she's very excited about that. So that was interesting for me because I knew when I was going into writing the book that part of what I was looking for was how her framework for Hollywood movies influenced the way she later would write about the intersection of movies and particularly American presidential politics. And so from that, I kind of learned that she was really interested in movies as a capsule for entertainment and as a sort of emotionally manipulative fun thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what bugged her so much when she started to perceive what she felt was a crossover between entertainment and the political kind of culture and the political discussion of the time, because she felt like, well, these two things should not be alike at all. And of course, I think we can easily see that they've basically merged at this point. So she was onto something.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was really interesting. And there's 3 years of columns in the Vogue archives. And at one point she shared the column with Pauline Kael, who she hated.
Yeah.
So that's all very funny to look at and read. I just don't feel, as a film critic, I was like, Joan, these aren't very good reviews.
Yeah.
But as a like historian of culture, they were really revealing.
Yeah, no, it's so funny. There was one that you highlighted where she's talking about... she described a film as competent, and somebody thought it was a kind of a backhanded compliment, or you know, not really praise. But she did intend it as praise because mm-hmm. competence is underrated as
yes.
as a truth of, you know, art and cinema. And I very strongly identified with that because I described something as competent the other day. And somebody yelled at me, and they were like, no, this is really good. I'm like, not mutually exclusive.
That's
not,
right.
Not...
Yes. It's also like when you use the word workmanlike, which I do sometimes. And what I mean is like, this gets the job done. Like, this is not going to maybe become one of the great classics of cinema, but it's like it's doing what it's supposed to do, and it's doing it well. Yeah, and I think she goes on to say that she remembers some guy at Berkeley where she went to school kind of sniffing at her and being like, the problem with you, Didion, is you admire competence. And she was like, yeah, I do.
Competence, underrated. It's just mm-hmm. It's just underrated. In the section where you're talking about her writing for National Review, it's interesting because she wasn't a... firebrand conservative, certainly,
right.
You know, voted for Goldwater, as you discuss, and kind of gets disillusioned with the GOP and the Nixon and then Reagan years. But it's interesting to think about that period of writing and culture writing and the importance that William F. Buckley Jr. kind of put on culture writing as a facet of a literary magazine. I mean, it really
yes.
is. Again, it's like it's this entirely different world from what we have now, where there is just not the same sort of emphasis.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I'm by no means a historian of National Review, but reading enough of the history to kind of get to the point where she's writing for them is also a point where there are people who, like Noel Parmentel, who she was dating for a long time, who would write for National Review one week and The Nation the next week and practically write like two sides of the same argument in those two publications. This is like impossible to imagine right
yeah.
now. It's sort of fascinating. I think there are like ups and downs to living in that world as a critic. But Buckley said we need to have good culture writing in here if anyone's going to take us seriously. And that meant sometimes, you know, going with people who weren't maybe ideologically aligned with him or with the magazine, but had really interesting takes on things. And that is so rare to find at this point. I think it used to be that you would like buy a magazine and you were buying the whole magazine. And so mm-hmm. no matter what you were there to read, you would have these other parts that were also there. And this is true of newspapers, and this is true. And you know, now it's things get kind of taken as articles instead of as like a cohesive whole that a magazine presents, which is an argument. And I think Buckley at least really understood that. And there were people who were conservative and became not so conservative who wrote for National Review. There were people who were never conservatives to begin with who wrote for National Review because it was one of the respected publications for a culture writer in the kind of late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah. No, it's, again, just a kind of fascinating different time. All right. So Joan Didion is writing in New York. She and Gregory Dunn are like, we're going out west. We're gonna make movies and do other things. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because, again, I like her time as a screenwriter and as a script doctor is one of the really interesting parts of this book, because again, I just didn't know much about it beyond her being the credited screenwriter of Al Pacino's first big movie.
Yes, it's
really interesting. So she moves out to California. What was the impetus there? What was her goal?
Yeah, I mean, this is happening at the end of that essay, Goodbye to All That. So, which I think a lot of people have read if they've read any Didion. And she's like, she basically says, we just couldn't stand being in New York anymore. We didn't like going to parties where everyone was just talking about who got a book deal. And to me, it's like, oh, so you moved to Hollywood where, you know, but I get it. And they took leave of absence. I think she quit her job and John took a leave of absence and they just moved to L.A. And his brother, Dominic, Nick Dunn, who is Griffin Dunn's father, was a and, you know, became a kind of influential writer in his own right at Vanity Fair later on. But he was a TV producer, not like a huge one, but he knew people. And so they figured, well, we could go write screenplays. And there was a lot of money in writing screenplays at the time. And that was where they started. And they actually wrote, they adapted the novel, well, it's sort of a nonfiction novel, Panic in Needle Park, for their first film. That was their first produced film. And that is the one that has a really incredible performance by Al Pacino and Kitty Wynn. And it's kind of one of the great drug movies of the era. And it is funny to watch it after you've read her film criticism, because I kind of feel like it's the sort of movie she might have picked at a bit when she reviewed. But it's interesting. And then, yeah, they kept kind of working. So right after that, they adapted her novel Play It As It Lays, which had been a hit. And that movie has just recently been restored. It was really hard to see for a long time. It just opened right before my book came out serendipitously in New York, and now it's going around the country. They wrote the screenplay for A Star Is Born with Barbara Streisand, although they weren't intending for it to be Barbara Streisand initially. They adapted his novel, True Confessions, and they wrote Up Close and Personal. And that experience was kind of a long development hell situation that John writes about in his book Monster, which is a great, great book about being in Hollywood. And they also wrote some teleplays. They adapted a couple things, including Hills Like White Elephants by Hemingway for HBO. It's just funny that this was an HBO thing, but it was like a sort of a three-part show where they adapted famous writers from the early 20th century. But when you look at their when you look at their screenwriting work, you see people who aren't really auteurist writers, which was what was popular at the moment that they arrived in Hollywood. People who really believed, like, you know, here I am, it's my art, I'm going to write these screenplays, they're going to be my thing. And they confess to being much more practical about it. They say, well, it, you know, pays the bills and we have private school tuition. And later on, they were like, we need the WGA health insurance because John has heart trouble. And I think as the journals, there was an excerpt from her journals in The New Yorker from a volume that's being published soon. She mentions a thing I didn't know in there, which is that she had cancer treatment in the 90s. So there was just sort of like health things that needed to be taken care of, and WGA insurance was pretty much the way to do it. And they were huge, huge fans of the WGA. But they thought of themselves as novelists who wrote journalism and also did this screenplay stuff. And so they punched up and did rewrites and all of the things that you do to make a living as a screenwriter. And that era lasted for about, gosh, Up Close and Personal, I think, came out in 96. So that's a good 25 years in that business, even though they moved back to New York in the 80s.
Yeah, Yeah. No, it's interesting. It's interesting remembering, you know, some of the things she had written about working in Hollywood and her kind of rejection of auteur theory in general. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this great passage I just want to read from your book here. This is you. The Hollywood power player is obsessed with the high of putting together the next film, even more than its possible result. Being at the center of everything is what matters. It's the adrenaline rush. And all those critics back in New York simply had no idea how the business really worked. They thought, wrongly, that Hollywood movies were the work of a single visionary genius. In a 1973 essay entitled In Hollywood, Didion wrote that, quote, some people, end quote, who write about films are so detached from the quote, circus, end quote, of the production that they'll never understand the, quote, social or emotional reality of the process, end quote. And it's that's really interesting here, the idea of the process itself as a kind of art form in and of itself.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, which really, you see it in all of her writing. It is not the work itself, it's how you get to the work.
Yes.
That is of interest to her and I think to us as readers of her.
Yeah, I think, you know, something that critics, as you know, we talk about amongst ourselves sometimes is that it's the most interesting thing about a movie is not what it's about, but how it's about what it's about. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that perspective is very much a part of the way she looks at everything. Whether she, like when she ends up doing political reporting later on, she's on campaign trails. But she's almost never writing about what the candidate's saying and like evaluating policy positions. She was like, other people are doing that. She's listening to what the aides are saying and how the handlers are talking and kind of like, you know, she's on the Dukakis campaign and she's watching him like throw a baseball multiple times so they can get the shot. And she's like, oh, I know what this is. And this is bothersome to me, which I think is what made her such a great. I mean, I think her politics were quite conservative pretty much to the end of her life, although mm-hmm. I think she would probably argue the party moved under her. I don't know. She did register as a Democrat, but I think she just liked voting in primaries. But her political writing is, you know, she kind of has it out for everybody pretty much. She's not certain. She doesn't see a big difference between political parties in America. And what she sees is a very big similarity in style and very little difference in substance. And that style is for her increasingly the style that she recognizes from being at those dinner parties and being in the room when people are doing the wheeling and dealing and holding court at the, you know, their favorite table at whatever LA restaurant to like get executives and people to talk to them. That all seems very familiar to her. And to the degree that it had been happening all along, I think she's right in that, you know, Hollywood logic and eventually kind of television becomes a major factor here, that the camera is pointing and grabbing a shot. And that is what people are increasingly thinking about.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. We'll talk about the increase of the importance of television in a second, because I think this is you know, the way we understand how conventions work is totally bonkers. Yes. Now and is driven entirely by TV. But the encroachment of Hollywood and the dream factory idea of creating images to sell to people.
Yes.
Is, again, I think the thing that underlines her, all of her political writing, all of like the way she helps us understand the world. And I mean, it's really striking. How did the rise of Reagan and Reaganism kind of influence that part of her personality, her brain?
Yeah, I mean, Reagan for her, I think, in the way that she loved John Wayne and he was the great love of her, you know, sort of parasocial life, Reagan was like her sworn enemy, even though it's not even totally clear to me that she ever talked to him. But she did very early on write a piece called Pretty Nancy. And it was when Reagan was governor. So she went to the governor's mansion and spent the day with Nancy Reagan. And it's a very mean piece. It's, you know, really Nancy Reagan was still talking about it decades later in her autobiography, so it stuck with her. But she, it's very succinct, and she basically just sees the Reagan governor's mansion as being a place where those shots are being set up, where everyone's acting and repeating lines. I mean, this is how she sees it from from the 60s onwards. And so for her, that was her, not the moment of her break with the California Republican Party. That happened slightly earlier with Nixon, who I think she just didn't like. But this was to her like the example of what she had seen, which was someone who was so used to repeating lines and sort of portraying an emotional truth that the and taking dictates from the studio, which she brings up a lot of times, because Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan both made comments to that effect at some point, and she latched onto it, that by the time he's in the White House, she's just like, absolutely not. Like, this is...
Yeah.
This isn't governance at all. And I don't think his specter kind of ever left her with any other politician. That you can just feel that in a lot of her political writing. I do recommend reading Political Fictions. I think it's a great read. But, you know, she's writing about Newt Gingrich, or she's writing about Bill Clinton or whatever. Yeah. And she's still kind of using the same framework that I think she really developed around watching the ascendancy of Reagan over time. And I do imagine it had, she also was sort of affronted as someone who, you know, definitely loved the Hollywood unions, and Reagan was very sort of well known for leading the most successful SAG strike when he was the president of SAG. So I think that was like an extra kind of tick in the wrong column for her.
Yeah, no, and it's, I mean, it really is interesting to look at her kind of evolution as a, you know, she's a Western conservative, big Goldwater fan.
Yep.
And I can understand going from Goldwater to Nixon and being like, I don't like this. But Reagan was kind of more in that spectrum.
Yes.
So it is, I mean, it's just very telling that, it's very telling how much she was put off by the showmanship of it all.
Yes.
I guess.
Yes, I think that's... I mean, Reagan was Goldwater's opening act on the campaign trail, literally, to the point where people would be like, who was that guy? And sometimes he'd come back and finish the campaign, like, event after Goldwater went off. I mean, she really loved Goldwater. She, in the intro to Political Fictions, which was published on September 11th, 2001, she writes, you know, had he remained the same age and kept running, I would have voted for him in every election, which is like a, you know, quite a thing to say, I think, in the book you're putting together in presumably 2000. And she was kind of famous for like alarming people at her dinner parties in Hollywood by saying that she, you know, was a Republican or was concerned that she had loved Goldwater.
Yeah.
But I think so. I mean, and this is total psychologizing on my part, and I have to say, like, I can't speak for her, but there's something about Goldwater that is John Wayne-esque. He's got that kind of Western guy, sort of like a big guy who just seems like he's going to take care of you, and he's handsome, but he's kind of got that like cowboy thing going on.
Yeah.
And I think her great love of John Wayne starts in childhood and is so baked into her psyche that he feels like the kind of political manifestation of this. And I think she saw him as straight talking, as like saying what he means, just all the things that she, as a Californian who valued her pioneer ancestors and saw every John Wayne movie, would have responded to. And Reagan was not that for her at all. And she was also she has an amazing, because it's very funny, essay about, I believe it's called Many Many Mansions in Slouching Towards Bethlehem, about the house that the Reagans had built because they didn't want to live in the governor's mansion, and then they like never ended up living in it. But she's just like, this is so boring and like stylish. It's trying too hard to be like in the know or something. The last line is something like, I have seldom seen any building so evocative of the unspeakable, which is just like a crazy thing to say about just what sounds like a very normal house. but I think there's the style difference there is perhaps subtle for us, but very clear to her. One person was signaling leadership, and one person was signaling feelings and kind of like making good pictures for the camera and selling people that idea. And that was where she landed with it.
Yeah. Let me go sideways just for a second, because you mentioned John Wayne, and yeah. You know, she grew up watching all the John Wayne movies. She was you know, saw him as a, you know, kind of grand mythic American archetype. But it's interesting to think about her perception of the film industry and what she was watching and how everything evolved from John Wayne and the Western to the motorcycle picture of the mid to late 60s, which is you mentioned this in your book. I don't have it in front of me, but it's this kind of shift from the idea of justice will prevail, there's somebody out there looking out to us, to we are in crazy times.
Mm-hmm.
We are in crazy, chaotic times, and there is not necessarily somebody coming to save us. I mean, I there's a real shift there, and she is into both of these.
Yes. Yes, she is. I mean, if you read her first novel, which I do recommend, although she kind of disavowed it, Run River, it's about about her nostalgia for California as she's living in New York, but it also is about the fading of a way of life that she felt very attached to, with the kind of the big farms and ranches and the rivers and the, like, the big old families in California. And later she attributed that to basically her pernicious nostalgia, which is a phrase she brings up a lot in her later writing. But I think she's really attached to this vision of California as, like, representative of the American spirit, or what the American spirit should be, which is, like, all our ancestors, they traveled over the mountains and they built this, you know, with their own hands. And, you know, part of this mythology for her mother in particular was, and they never took any federal money to do it, which she later is like, wait a second, that's totally not true. Of course we did. But, you know, that was the mythology there. And I think, like, John Wayne for her represents that whole pioneering spirit, and also a kind of comfort and safety that she always craved. And instead of the world feeling more safe as time went on, and she came of age right after the World Wars, but instead of the world feeling more safe, to her it feels progressively less safe. And when she's watching the biker movies, she is feeling like they are the new generation's manifestation of whatever the Western was supposed to be, that they're scary, they're violent, they're chaotic, they're, you know, drug addled, all of these things. But that somehow to her was almost like a, I think she says like an ideogram of the future or something like that. But it's like, that's a depiction of how it feels to be living now. And there were a whole bunch of other things going on. I mean, she was living in Hollywood, the Manson murders, you know, happened. Yeah, she also was diagnosed with, I believe, MS in that period. She's a new mother, but she's not taking to it very well. Like, there's a lot of kind of really difficult things happening at that same time. But yeah, that shift is pretty significant for her. And I think she was self-aware enough to know that her idealism of the Westerns and the kind of John Wayne thing are just that. They're daydreaming. And that's kind of her perception of it over time. But they're, you know, it's certainly hard to let go of the thing you loved as a child that made you feel safe, and that was something she wanted.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I mean, hop back to the train of thought I was on before. The rise of TV as the kind of mediating influence on American politics, which you discuss mostly, or at least in part, in the context of the conventions, is very interesting in kind of the stage managed way. When she's like watching, you know, when she's writing about the conventions and kind of watching how they're evolving and how the executives at the TV networks are talking about them, how does that kind of influence her coverage of these, but also just her idea of what politics is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, conventions are increasingly staged for the cameras over the period of time that she's writing about them. She really hates them, I think, actually. I mean, there's at some point later on, she's writing for the New York Review of Books, which means her editor is Robert Silvers, who's sort of the legendary founder of that publication. And he kept getting her to come back and write about conventions, and at some point she just was like, I can't. She walked out entirely because this was just too much, and she finished on TV. But I think they were bewildering, and also the arc was clear that, like, you know, we used to do things for the people in the room, and now the people in the room are, she hears somebody mention them as extras.
Mm-hmm.
She overhears this, and that for her is like obviously a light bulb going on if she hadn't been thinking of it already, where it was indicative, I think, to her of how the parties were thinking of the country as a whole, that almost everybody is an extra in this little drama that they've concocted. And the only people who matter are the thin slice of people who can sway an election one way or another. And that to her is, again, like, disturbing, not the way she thinks things should be done in America. And also a way of kind of it means that you wind up pre-selecting the candidate who plays best on TV, not the candidate who, you know, best embodies the values of your party or something like that. And of course, we can take that all the way back to the Kennedy-Nixon debates, which she certainly would have been very aware of. And Nixon losing in part because he just didn't look very good on camera next to JFK, which, fair. But that, you know, that's a scary thing when you start performing your most important sort of determiner of a lot of factors that influence people's lives by, like, what makes for the best shot on camera. And she also started seeing all the news organizations were getting these, like fancy spots up in, you know, the best places in the convention. And it's just like, what is this? It's literally a circus, you know? And for her, that is just another kind of brick in that wall, I guess. That's kind of a bad metaphor, but
totally. And also kind of congruent with this, there is the rise of the swing voter, you know, the quote, the idea of you have the 48% who's voting one way, you got 48% who's voting another way, there's a 4% slice in the middle, and we have to craft our message specifically for them, which she recognized from test screenings.
Yes, right. So she writes very specifically about polling, and John does too, to an extent. So it's kind of funny to look back and remember that. So her husband, in addition to writing Monster, wrote one of the other great books about Hollywood, The Studio, which has no relation, as far as I know, to the Seth Rogen miniseries, but more is the pity. It's funny because it's set, and she must have heard him talking about it because she was not in all the rooms that he was. He had unfettered access given to him by Zanuck to the 20th Century Fox backlot in the year that Dr. Doolittle was coming out, which was just kind of an unmitigated disaster when it came out, in part because Rex Harrison was a nightmare to work with, and in part because they just couldn't get a handle on the movie. And they did a ton of test screenings and a lot of polling, and they would take the movie out on the road and they would show it to people and then they would tweak it and they would change things about it. And so by the end, you know, it's not the movie you set out to make. It's some other movie that people want to watch. And the two of them were very aware of that because they would go through that process with their own movies over and over again.
Yeah.
Most famously Up Close and Personal. But yeah, I mean, I think the test screening idea where you just you put a whole new ending on it, there's no integrity to be preserved in the story for them and for most movies. You get the one that kind of people respond to. And then they notice that this is happening more and more with politics and that you're doing precisely the same kind of thing to find what plays best to the small slice of audience that you want to, you know, quote unquote, buy tickets to this and tell their friends to buy tickets to it too. It's funny to me that they don't talk, neither of them talk much in terms of fans, which to me feels like an excellent lens through which to understand contemporary politics.
Mm-hmm.
But that is essentially what they're talking about. How do studios make fans out of consumers, which makes them loyal and wanting to come back, even if the thing itself isn't very good anymore. And the way you do that is by just kind of creating those people who are, you know, interested in what you're doing no matter what, or want to buy it pretty much no matter what you do. And that is kind of the evolution of American politics.
No, the idea of, I mean, I fandom as a pernicious influence is everywhere, including in politics. I mean, it's that's a whole nother book. That's something else. But the swing voter thing is interesting too, because it ties into another thing that she is interested in, and you kind of pick up on, which again is it's not the thing, it's the response to the thing. And this comes up in the context towards the end of your book about the Central Park Five and the Terri Schiavo case, where it's you know, it's not necessarily the actual attack in Central Park. It's not necessarily the woman who, you know, is on the life support system. It's how everybody else is responding to this that's interesting, which I think, again, this is how I process almost everything these days. Like, I've gotten to the point where I almost can't think about a thing except in context to how that thing is being parsed on social media or in the regular media or whatever. It's
absolutely,
it's impossible. It's just, it's like, I don't know. And I, like, again, I identify very strongly with Didion on this front, because it is the story of our time. It's not the thing, it's the reaction to the thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The Schiavo piece was a surprise to me. I didn't know that it existed until pretty late. I just missed it in my first pass. There's a lot of writing out there that she did. And that one, that one was of interest to me in part because I remember it as a kid. I remember hearing people talk about it on Christian talk radio, and I remember discussions in church or other contexts. And so reading her on it, it's really interesting because she is actually very personally invested in what's happening at that moment and the questions that are being debated across the broader public, in part because her own daughter had just been on life support for 7 or 8 months after a concussion. And so she is obviously thinking about all the moral and ethical questions at play. And it's not that she isn't interested in it, but for her, the big story here is that everyone has made this somehow their own personal thing that they're passionate about. And nobody's thought about, they don't know her, you know, and she's very concerned and kind of weirded out by that. It made me think of Alexander Payne's movie Citizen Ruth, which I mentioned in there, but just the kind of tendency to one case that is not it's not a singular case. This happens all the time. You know, people are, especially in the 80s, you know, mugged and hurt in Central Park all the time. She writes in the Central Park Five essay about a Black woman who had died just a week before in a brutal thing, and yet nobody had really written, it hadn't become a case of national importance. And she is this is because to her, media and politicians pick up on kind of the perfect story and spin it into something that we can all talk about and debate and feel ourselves part of, even though in all actuality we are not part of that, other than kind of on a broad love thy neighbor scale. And that to me is really good media criticism. And it's also, you know, as a child, I definitely thought, or I guess a teenager, I definitely thought this was the only time this had ever happened to anybody being on life support in a debate about taking them off. But of course it wasn't, you know, it was just that this was the one that hit the headlines the right way at that moment. And for her, you know, that again is the entertainment impulse. Again, not that it hadn't happened before, but the spinning up of the kind of media that we have now and the way that punditry is perhaps rewarded over sober analysis or something like that, that's what she's really responding to there.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. I want to ask kind of as exit question is the wrong word, because I have one more question after this. But if you wanted to recommend a book or a collection of Didion's to someone to kind of help them understand, you know, like you say, there's a lot of writing out. There's a lot of Joan Didion writing out there, which, you know, and we're all very busy people, you know,
yes.
who has the time? Yeah. But what would you recommend folks pick up to get the best overall sense of her POV?
Yeah, I mean, she does go through periods in her writing, and she is kind of rare as a writer who I think actually is constantly reevaluating her point of view, even like into her late work. But I'll just say, I think Political Fictions is a great way to get a feel for her perspective, both on entertainment and on American politics. And also there's a little bit of criticism in there too, so you kind of get the smorgasbord of everything. But if I were to say one other, I think one that's read less than it should be is her 2003 book, Where I Was From, which is a collection of kind of long reported pieces about California and about her re-encountering and re-evaluating the mythology that she was raised with and has really held well into adulthood about California, which is also really about her family, but it's also really about America. So there's a lot there, and it's sort of rare to find a writer doing that kind of thing late in life. And I think mm-hmm. that's really indicative of her philosophical ideas about stories we tell ourselves in order to live and, you know, kind of the yeah. way we try to make meaning out of chaos, and then we have to face facts sometimes and realize that they actually reevaluate our own stories. So both of those, I think, are usually not the ones that you might find on the front table at the bookstore, but they're definitely worth looking at.
Excellent. All right. So now this is the exit question. I always like to ask if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know about your book, about Joan Didion, you know, state of yeah. the universe, whatever. what did we not discuss that we should have?
Well, this has been a great conversation. I will say, you know, one of the most interesting things about writing this book was that I was very aware that Didion, well, so I sold it to my publisher before she died, but I mm-hmm. was still aware that she was probably not going to be with us too much longer, and that everybody loves a Joan Didion book, so I figured there'd be a bunch more, and I wanted to make sure I kind of had an angle on it that would be fresh. Mm-hmm. And there have, in fact, been at least three books published in between her death and mine coming out. But my hope was that people who like Didion or think they like Didion or love Didion and have read everything she's ever written will find like a fresh angle. But then also that people who don't care or who have like read her and don't really like her very much will also kind of get a good sweep of, you know, it's a story that I'm telling, but it's about like American political culture and Hollywood as much as it is about Didion. And I think all three of them pair together really well. But it was very fun to write it as a little bit of a cultural biography of American political culture as much as of Didion. So that's the aim in the book. I barely mention contemporary politics in it. I kind of end it around 2005, and then there's a little bit after that, but I think it feels like I keep thinking about things I said in the book now, which I think hopefully is useful, and also you don't have to read yet another book with the word Trump in it if you don't want to.
There's a kind of a looming cloud over everything else, so
yes.
you know it's not there. But I will say, look, again, I do think it's I don't think you can understand modern politics without understanding the influence of showbiz on it. And there are few people who traverse that world as fluidly and frankly, carefully and well as she did. So
yes.
this is a good primer for late stage American, whatever this is, wherever we are right now.
Technical name for it. Yeah. No, I hope that's true. And and I hope it just gets people into reading her more through that lens and understanding her really as a cultural critic and not just like the woman who wrote essays about being sad and confused in California.
Yeah. Alyssa, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much. This has been really great.
And my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and we'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.